Welcome to another edition of Sandy Klein's Conversations with Creative Women. Meet Sharon Katz. Born in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, now known as Nelson Mandela Bay, she grew up under the old apartheid regime. As a teenager, she hid under blankets in the backseat of a friend's car, sneaking out to the blacks-only townships. There she met with the now-famous actors in the Atoll Fugards group and began her lifelong mission of using music to break down racial barriers. In 1992, inspired by Mandela's release from prison, Sharon made history of her own. The singer-musician brought together 500 black, white, colored, and Indian children to form the country's first-ever multicultural and multilingual choir. The group's first performance was at Durban City Hall, and the production was called When Voices Meet. While that was huge, it was just the beginning. She wanted to take that musical message, promoting a peaceful transition to democracy, all over South Africa. So what followed was Sharon Katz and the Peace Train, which has continued spreading its message of peace and reconciliation through performances and workshops around the world. The story is documented in the film aptly titled When Voices Meet. Sharon also composed and directed Crossing Rhythms, a music and dance production that featured more than 200 performers from across the African continent and had South Africa's Philharmonic playing African music for the first time in history. With proceeds from CD sales and contributions to a nonprofit organization, Friends of the Peace Train, Sharon has established music therapy programs for those impacted by HIV/AIDS, conflict resolution work in violence-ravaged regions, the building of schools and community arts centers, and she also conducts workshops in schools and universities across the United States. Sharon, welcome. What a history, what a story. I can't wait for you to fill in all the details.
Oh, thanks, Sandy. Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be with you on the show. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start by talking about those teenage years when you hung out in black-only townships. How did you pull that off?
I could say that I was really fortunate, you know, to be in the right place at the right time. At the age of 15, I was in the basement of a church in Port Elizabeth. At a show, a play that was being produced. And it was very much undercover, under wraps, kind of literally underground because it was in the basement of the church. But it was underground in the sense of that play could never have been shown on the big stages in the theaters, because it was a group of actors, as you said in your introduction, that were working with Ethel Fugard, the renowned South African playwright. And they were doing a production of an adaptation of a Albert Camus play, actually called The Just. But they had adapted it for the South African situation. And being as young as I was and already hating the government, the apartheid regime at that age already, I was totally conscientized by this play and very, very moved by the actors. And there were four black actors, two males, two females, and John Carney and Winston Chona were actually, they're very, very famous today. But back in the day, they weren't very much heard of, except that they were working with Ethel. And I was just so moved that I ran up to them after the show and, you know, made plans to get together and illegally, secretly met up with, they became very good friends. And that's how I made those sort of forbidden forays out to the townships, was through the now very well-known John Carney and Winston and Shona. So we became very good friends ever since.
Yes, but come on, Sharon. I mean, what you did was really unorthodox. How did you pull that off? Who supported you? Did your parents know what you were doing?
No, my parents knew nothing about it. I just was this willful kid. I don't know how to explain it, Sandy. I've always been an individualist. I've always been a rebel. I was really into music from a very young age. And I'm just a person that loves people. And I basically fell in love with these actors. And I used to go downtown, take the bus into town, into Main Street, Port Elizabeth. So I guess you could say it was early 70s, late 60s, really, mm-hmm. Unbeknown to my family. And I used to go and meet up with Winston, who was one of the actors. He's still acting today. And his wife, Viuela, she worked as a quote-unquote tea lady in one of the white company. And I used to go and have tea with V and sit and talk to her. And And then I would say, you know, I'd love to meet your family, because I was very upset as a child about the conditions that Black people were living under, and that, you know, women would work in the city, in the towns, in the suburbs, and they would hardly ever see their children. And so here was an opportunity for me to relate on a human level, on a normal, quote unquote, normal level, mm-hmm. to a Black woman. And we were friends. We became friends. And, you know, the Black people of South Africa, I just have to say, there is something special about South Africa altogether. And I'll just preface all my statements by that, because by her befriending a white girl my age, you know, I was young, I was 15. Anyway, one day, and she was so warm and so loving, and one day she said, okay, you know, all right, we'll meet up with Winston after work, and you'll come with me home, and then we'll bring you home, we'll bring you back again. So it was literally, we actually portray this in the documentary, but it, because John, we interviewed John Carney for the documentary, and I'm still friends with John today. And he talked about all of this and described it. But so that's basically what happened. And then I would go in the car, at the back of the car, they would cover me over, because there were always police barriers at the entrances to townships in those days.
To Black-only townships.
To Black townships at that time, yeah. And you had to mm-hmm. have a permit. If you were white, I guess doctors, certain businesses, people, you know, adults could get permits. But this was without a permit, so they would hide me. And I would literally hear the officers, the policemen asking to see a pass, asking my friends to show their passes.
Were they much older than you?
I mean, John's probably about 10 years old. It's 10 or 15 years older than me. Let me see.
And they just took it with you showing up as just par for the course, in a sense?
No, well, I used to go and visit them in other situations which were legal. I used to go to the hospital where they, the Livingston Hospital, where they would rehearse. I used to get myself to Livingston and watch them rehearsing at Livingston. They used to perform plays in other sort of like a Jewish center. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, they would perform the play there. So we became friends. And then also I invited them. This was strictly illegal. I would invite my friends, my Black actor friends, right, to come to my house when my parents were out. And then I'd be like, I'd serve them tea, you know, and because this was illegal. This was one of the apartheid laws. You were not allowed to drink tea with Black people.
That's just
Can you get your mind around
No,
that?
I cannot. I cannot understand
so
that.
So as a 14, 13, 14, 15-year-old, to me, it was sick. You know, I'm Jewish. I grew up, you know, learning about the Holocaust. And to me, this was a Holocaust. And it was a Holocaust. I mean, you can't underestimate the cruelty and the viciousness and the brutality of the apartheid regime.
Your parents were clueless about what you were doing.
They had no idea. None. I mean, I didn't tell my parents.
You're a ballsy broad, Sharon Katz.
Many years later when they read about it in newspaper articles. But, you know, no, I didn't tell my parents because I didn't want to endanger them. And also, I didn't want to worry them.
Sure.
And it was important to break the laws, actually, at that point, because, you know, how else was there going to be a change if white people weren't conscientized like me?
Right.
And if relationships weren't formed, how else was change going to ever come about in South Africa? And as I wasn't the only person doing this, I didn't know anybody at the time like me, but there were certainly people that were whites, Jews, that joined the protest movement against apartheid in South Africa, and in their own ways were in the struggle.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Sharon Katz, who is born in South Africa and who is the force behind Sharon Katz and the Peace Train. Sharon, did you always know that you wanted to sing and make music and use it for the greater good?
Always, Sandy. And that's an amazing thing because, you know, I grew up in the Jewish community and I was in the socialist Zionist movement called Habonim. And it was very much a humanist program, which I really resonated with the socialist cause, you know, with those concepts of am I my brother's keeper, if I'm not for myself, who is for me, if not now, when, you know, all of these kinds of things that we learned in the movement became very important to me when I could apply them as a South African, you know, as a child growing up in this really unjust, inhumane society. And somehow or other, that all played a part in my upbringing. And I think my parents being the really warm and generous people that they were, obviously they also had a huge impact on my life and who I was. And I just gravitated towards using music in a social way. So my first band that I had, I think I was 12 or 13 years old, we used to go and entertain children in homes, in children's homes.
You had a band when you were 12 years old?
I did. I had a band. It was called the Shalom Bomb. Not so far away from the peace train, if you think about it.
Not at all. Not at all. So and you knew you had a cause. It sounds like you were sort of born into social activism. But having said that, you know, it's one thing to be a social activist. It's another to have talent. So the two were able to merge because you had both.
I was very lucky. I was blessed.
Did you assume as you were getting older that that was how you were going to earn your living?
No. I never thought that I could do that because I didn't have any role models in my family, like as far as musicians went. I never really thought that that would be an option for me at all until many, many years later when I heard about music therapy. I happened to be living in a village in a country called Lesotho, which is surrounded by South Africa, but it was an independent African country.
Sure.
But I went up to live in the mountains of Lesotho where I worked in a mission school back in 1978. It was after I had finished high school. But I then became aware through reading, through friends, through various mentors that I had in through the university system at University of Cape Town, I became aware of music therapy. And I talked to my parents about it. They loved the idea because they knew, you know, they knew my talent and they knew my love of people. I was always really gregarious, and I studied music therapy. I managed to come to America through my parents, who really believed in, you know, this field. They thought it was perfect for me, and they were right. And I managed to come to, that's what brought me to Philadelphia in the 80s. So in the early 1980s, 1981, during the state of emergency in South Africa, I came to Philadelphia and I began to study for a master's in music therapy, master's degree. And it was perfect for me. But I worked in the system for about 10 years within the United States through in the mental health system. Mm-hmm. I worked in the prisons. I worked in with every kind of special needs population that you can actually think of. I got a broad range of experience. Then I decided to go home and just roll up my sleeves. It was just after Mandela was released from prison in 1990. I met Marilyn, and together we decided to fly back to South Africa and just try to work and become involved in the transition from the old apartheid to the new democracy. And that's what gave birth to the peace train.
So Mandela was released in 90. Your choir was formed in 92. This change was just not going to happen overnight.
Definitely not. No, I mean, you know, the laws were changing. And of course, Mandela was now free. But that period of time during which we mounted the peace train, there was a civil war in KwaZulu-Natal where we mounted the peace train, around Durban and in that province, because you still had, first of all, the old apartheid government was still in power.
Right.
Although Mandela was free. And now the political parties that had been underground, like the African National Congress, were slowly coming out of their little offices. I mean, literally, they had been in prison, you know?
Right.
They had been in jail. All these people were in jail. Now they were free. They were becoming free, but they were still operating out of small offices in Durban. I mean, tiny little holes in the wall when we went to Durban in 92. But they immediately... The people that we met are now in government ministers, including our president, our current president, Jacob Zuma. He knew the peace train very well. And they loved and resonated with exactly what we were talking about, which was let's get the youth together. Because although, you know, Mandela's free, you know, the ANC was still, as I said, just coming out of hiding, basically, coming out of secrecy.
Just getting its sea legs. Almost.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Inkatha Freedom Party, which was led by Chief Gacha Buthelezi. And they had been puppets of the South African regime for so long, the South African apartheid government. And now there was a conflict between the Inkatha Freedom Party, the African National Congress, and then you still had the old government that was fueling Inkatha. And there was a major war going on. Scores of people were being killed every single day. In KwaZulu-Natal. It was a dangerous time. And that was the atmosphere into which the peace train rode. And it was called the peace train because we needed peace in KwaZulu-Natal. We needed peace in South Africa as a whole, you know. So those 4 years between 1990 leading up to elections were really, really violent.
What prompted you to form this 500-member choir? How hard was it to pull it off?
Well, I was thinking, Sandy, that, you know, we needed to do something big, you know, because the times were momentous. And we needed to do something that could match the enormity of what was going on in the country. You know, Mandela was out of jail. We didn't have elections. It was obvious that we, elections were coming, but there was no date set for the elections. The date was only set for the elections after the assassination of Chris Hani, which was in April 1993. And that was, we were already in the process. We had already had our 500-voice choir already by that time. So all I can say is what prompted me was just the passion, you know, to know that change was coming and people weren't ready for change.
Yes, but come on, Sharon, how did you get a colored child with a black child, with an Indian child, with a white child to stand next to each other and sing together?
First of all, Marilyn Cohen, I met her in Philadelphia, and she was very, very excited about the change that was happening in South Africa. She heard me performing here in the States, and she wanted me to go and work in one of the mental health programs in Philadelphia. And I said, no, I'm going back to South Africa. I need to go now because things have changed. I'm ready to go. But she sort of was the wind beneath my wings in the sense that she said, I'll come, I'll help, you know, and that's what really helped to make up my mind that I could do it. So we really landed in Durban. We really walked the street. We were looking for a vehicle and sponsorship to be able to do what we knew we could do as a team, mm-hmm. you know, between mm-hmm. us. Because she's a social worker, social policy administration, a therapist, and I was a musician. And Marilyn's got incredible management skills. So she saw the potential. And also the sheer determination and passion that I had. And, you know, I basically got myself up and running with a band pretty quickly with musicians mm-hmm. and started to do what I always did do, which was go out to townships, go and visit people where they are. Now it was legal, but still dangerous.
Sure.
And made friends with musicians, started to go out to the townships, visiting schools. Pretty soon, I managed to get a little bit of work doing workshops here and there for the local performing arts councils. You know, South Africa is a developed country. There are things that are happening in South Africa. And there were certain people that recognized my talent. They needed what I had to offer, and they would hire me to do things here and there. And then I heard about an opportunity through the local performing arts council where they wanted a choir. They had room on their calendar for a choral production. And I applied for the position. And I got the job. And then I told them that I wanted to mount a 500-voice choir, and they thought I was around the bend.
Totally, that's a great expression.
Totally crazy. And basically everybody said, you'll never be able to do that. But, you know, go ahead and try it. The stage is there. You can do whatever you want. And so, you know, Marilyn also thought I was around the bend, but she's got used to the fact that I do have these ideas, you know. And we set about doing just that. And we had to travel from early in the morning until late at night to go to all these separated township areas.
And then it comes together. And how does that work among the children? How did they handle it?
Well, that's a really good question, because when we would go to the black townships, the kids would say to me straight up, you know, white children are not going to sing these songs. I don't know, you know, they didn't believe that children were going to sing, for example, one of my songs. It was called The Time is Right Today. The time is right today, Maibuye, Maibuye Africa. So Maibuye Africa means Africa's coming back. It was a slogan from the struggle. And then it says, the world is changing and the time is right to walk together into the light. It's time for changing and rearranging. We've got to sing together, black and white. So now this was like revolutionary because the black kids didn't believe that white kids would be singing these lyrics.
Well,
and I would tell them, yes, they are, because from here we're going to be driving 45 minutes to back into town, back into the city of Durban, which, by the way, is where my mother comes from, Durban. And we're going to be teaching at the Durban Girls' School, which is my mother's school, also alma mater. We're going to be teaching these kids at Durban Girls and Durban Boys, these white kids. They're going to sing these songs and these lyrics. And, you know, it was a stretch of imagination for a lot of the children, but they were enjoying themselves. They loved music. And when it all came together and we brought all the choirs together in City Hall for the first time, it was unbelievable. Because we had 500 children rubbing shoulders with each other, but we separated them into their voice parts. So that's how the mixing started, was because we had children from all schools rubbing shoulders with each other, singing alto, singing tenor, singing soprano, singing bass. And then I would physically go to the kids and I'd say, look, I grew up under apartheid. Those days are over now. We can live together. Things are changing, you know. And so I motivated them, and I would move them physically and say, okay, let's break it up now. Let's have everybody standing together. Siyazi mixa. Let's mix it up, you know. And I would speak in Zulu and different languages. And the kids loved it.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Sharon Katz, born in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. She's a musician, she's a teacher, and she also is the founder of the Peace Train. So, Sharon, these 500 boys and girls are singing around the country, and you're figuring out how the hell are we going to get them from point A to point B. And that's how the Peace Train came to be.
That's absolutely right, Sandy. Well, we started in Durban, you know, and we did two massive concerts in Durban City Hall. That was all that there was funding for, you know, and it was, it's always been for the love of it, you know. I mean, it's really, you know, I think if I wanted to make money, I would have never chosen to do what I do, because it's always scraping, you know, my whole life. And that's how the project was from the beginning. It was because we had to have shirts made. We had to find sponsors for buses to bring all the children together. We had to get sponsorship to make for each child to wear a shirt the same color so that it looked beautiful. They were like these purple colored shirts. And we did these two concerts, I think, in Durban. Then we did another concert in one of the townships. And then that was it. You know, there was no more money. And it was like, okay, what can we do? We really have to take the message around the country. And the concerts had been filmed by the Broadcasting Corporation of South Africa. And also they'd broadcast us on radio. So people were phoning and saying, when can we see this? We need to see this. We need to hear this message. And that's what prompted us to try to mount the project by rail. And we said, you know, let's see if we can go by train.
So how long was the Peace Train rumbling through South Africa?
The Peace Train tour itself was actually 11 days and 11 nights. And, it was so, I don't know what words to use for this tour. It was almost euphoric, although it was happening during a civil war. We were threatened. It wasn't easy. There were people that didn't want to see this happen. But the forces of good were stronger than the forces of evil. And, you know, you had Mandela. It was the run-up to the elections. It was before elections. And Nelson Mandela was everywhere on television, constantly talking about peace.
Did you know Mandela personally?
I met him through that time. I actually met him. I performed for his 75th birthday, and I had a multicultural band, and he loved it. He spoke to me, and he just said such beautiful words that really inspired me for the rest of my life.
So here are these children, and friendships are forged that carry them into adulthood, because that's what's evident in the documentary, when as these adults now are reflecting back to what it was like to be a black child or a white child or a colored child singing all together.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it had a tremendous impact on them, Sandy, because, you know, they were at the forefront of the change, this generation of children that we worked with. And they are really marked forever. It's so obvious in their interviews, because they just spoke from their hearts about their experience. And these kids had a tremendous opportunity. Not only did they sing in a big choir of 500 and travel around the country by train, some of them traveled to America with me. They traveled to West Africa with me. They performed all over, you know, all over South Africa. They were like little celebrities, you know. But they really, we also had a leadership component, a leadership training program as a part of what we were doing. And Marilyn and I are both therapists. You know, I was a music therapist, still am. And so we ran our groups as therapeutic communities where children learned to develop a sense of trust. And it was like a family, like a big family, involving the parents as well from all these different communities. So we really moved as a collective.
You're based now in Philadelphia, but you go back and forth.
I do. My base in America is Philadelphia, but my home is really Durban, South Africa. And that when I go to South Africa, I don't own a home. Actually, I don't own a home anywhere.
So you're free to come and go and do whatever you want, and that's just such a good thing.
Yeah, it in some ways, yeah, it does give you that freedom. And the children in Philadelphia, in Durban, many of them are almost like our own children. A couple of them we really took care of, you know, in a large way because they came from very difficult situations, some of them. And they're very successful today. It's amazing how well they're doing.
So what's in the future for you, Sharon? I know the documentary, When Voices Meet, you're promoting that. But what's going on for you personally and professionally?
Well, you know, it's just Sandy, you know, I'm almost at it's a new era in a way, you know, because of the film. I feel that the film has got so much potential for education, not only abroad and in America and other countries, but also in South Africa. And sort of in my deepest heart, I would love to go back to South Africa for periods of time and travel with a film and in association with a film, continue as I will everywhere doing concerts. But in South Africa, I'd like to do some more training and development workshops and sort of just continue because the message is really needed at home as well. It's needed to, you know, the inspiration and the positive message is very much needed in South Africa still today. We've got tremendous challenges in South Africa to overcome. But, you know, I'm a performer, I'm an artist, and that's also my big, deep love. So I just hope that the film will also help the Peace Train Band to become more well-known so we can also continue performing worldwide, you know.
And you take the Sharon Katz Peace Train on the road.
Yeah, we do. We go as a band. I don't travel with a choir anymore because it's just too
unwieldy, right?
It's really, we did. We traveled as a 35-member production for many, many years. And it's just with finances, it's so, so taxing. So, I mean, even as a 5 or 6 or 7-piece band, it's a challenge. But yeah, we travel wherever we get invited. We love to go and perform, do shows. And we like to do residencies if we can. We were actually resident on a college campus or in a high school where we can really impact on the children and the students over a period of weeks, you know, a couple of days and culminate in a production.
What you do is just so invaluable. And you know what I don't get, Sharon? How come you haven't been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize?
Thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure to get to know you better and to talk with you. And you just do the most wonderful work. You're inspirational. And I would like Sharon Katz and the Peace Train to serenade us as we end this conversation. It has been honestly my honor, Sharon.
Thank you so much for your interest, for your support. And, you know, just to continue promoting the cause of peace and equal rights and opportunities.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Hippos! Hippos!